The title of this session today is The Call to Solidarity with Central Americans, The Challenge of North American Churches. I'm Barry Shelley. I think all of you have been in at least one session, so you already know that, so I won't take any more time to introduce myself. After doing sessions all week on Central America, primarily El Salvador, this morning what I wanted to do was just explore the whole notion of what solidarity really means. And how we are called as North Americans to respond to the crisis in El Salvador and other places in Central America, and to try to do that in fairly concrete ways. I don't plan to do a theology of missions this morning, and really just want to talk a little bit about out of my experience again, and on both sides of the Gulf of Mexico, in the sense of what are North Americans who work in El Salvador doing and why, and also what people here are doing and why, and look at a little bit at the notions there, and talk a little bit about some of the struggles that we in El Salvador who work there have around the whole issue of solidarity and what that means. I mean, it's a daily kind of thing to try to figure out what you do in terms of your lifestyle and your program and those kinds of things to really truly be in solidarity. I also hope that we'll just have time for any questions or comments you might have about anything that we've talked about this week. I think most of you have been at least one or two sessions. Heather definitely deserves an award for sticking with me. I think she's been in every session so far. Heather and, I mean, Laura, too. I knew you were here before. I was thinking, where did she go? Okay, so let me offer a few reflections and pose some questions. And then I'll probably want to close with just a few closing sort of quotes that I think might be helpful for us to carry with us. Let's start with just the word solidarity. I mean, what does it mean for all of you? Either in the very specific sense of Central America or in more general terms. What does the word solidarity mean? All right, I think all of those are very crucial parts of what it has come to mean, especially when it comes to North Americans working with Central Americans. And it's now a fairly common word for anyone who works in Central American issues or any other issues around the world. And it's more and more used even by sort of mainline denominations. The other word often used in sort of mission boards is a partnership. But really trying to sort of see a shift in our theology and philosophy of how we do missions, quote unquote, in the world. Sometimes dictionary definitions are helpful. In this case, I think it sort of is. The Random House Dictionary says that solidarity, at least one definition, is union or fellowship arising from common responsibilities and interest as between members of a group or between classes and peoples. So that if we had solidarity between the peoples of North America and the peoples of Central America, we're talking about fellowship or union with common responsibilities and interests. And so what is the implications of what some of the stuff that we've talked about in this definition for missions, generally from the church? How does that differ from the traditional model where basically people went as missionaries to countries to either very clearly save their souls or to work in churches there in a way that was clearly them bringing the resources to do whatever needed to be done. And what now is we're trying to do is shift that away from some sense of still an evangelism in one sense of that word, what the real sense, I think, but of sharing God's love, but of sharing that with each other. And because, especially in Central America, I mean, the people there are already Christians, and I think we don't have anything on them spiritually, believe me. There's a sense of mutuality, which means that we've got to recognize the power issues involved, we automatically bring as North Americans a certain kind of power through our resources that we have got to struggle with our Central American brothers and sisters. And it's not going to be easy. There are going to be differences of the way things are seen, the way we respond to different issues. There are going to be differences in how we organize ourselves. There are going to be, and how we perceive everything from one specific meeting to how we're going to structure something. But it means that we're willing to try to struggle through some of those power issues and some of those differences and to try to learn from each other. And I guess I just want to stress it from the outset that I think probably most of us here would agree with this. Some, unfortunately, a lot of people, I think, lose sight of it, is that we have much to learn from Central Americans. Things that I would specifically say that I've learned a tremendous amount from Central Americans on are simply how to read the Bible, history itself. I think Central Americans have a much more keener sense of history than we do. I'll talk a little bit more about that at the very end. They've taught me a lot about what resurrection is. If we have time, we can talk more maybe about some of this stuff. About hope. Hope not being, if any of you who were in the forum the other night, we talked about hope a little bit, and some people talking about hope in terms of whether it's connected directly to results or not. I think Central Americans certainly are results-oriented in one sense of really pushing for certain signs of the kingdom and pushing to create certain changes. But their hope is based in simply a posture of life. It's a sense that life has meaning. And their hope is not primarily tied to bringing about results. If it was, most people would have given up a long time ago. Taught me a lot about salvation, about joy, about courage, about risk and faith, how those two go together. In our North American churches, we primarily help each other get out of taking risks. I really believe that. That's primarily what we do in our communities, is we help people feel less guilty. Whereas Central Americans hold each other accountable, at least in certain communities, and say, if you're going to be faithful, yes, you need to consider this, this, and this. And risk is part of being a Christian. It's not something that you avoid. It's all part of the gospel. So that, what we, I think, need to come to a sense of solidarity to this relationship that we're talking about with is a sense that we need Central Americans as much and perhaps more as they need us. Because I'm convinced that the North American church is in pretty bad shape. And it is really some of the lessons from Central Americans and other Latin Americans and South Africans and other Africans and Asians that can really help us to renew our own church. Okay, so that is sort of a simple sort of introduction to solidarity. Let's just talk a little bit about what do church workers do in El Salvador, our North American church workers. I'm not going to talk about churches like the Assemblies of God and the Pentecostal churches who are there and have a very different view of what they're doing, primarily involved in sort of competing for converts in some ways, very, very individually oriented, involved in social programs that they have are very often very much just sort of handouts. Maybe that's not fair completely to categorize all of what they do like that, but primarily going to talk about North American church workers with whom I have contact. And obviously there are many, as one would expect, there are many roles, and they're certainly not homogeneous in their philosophy either completely. But there are people who work as priests. There are a lot of people who work as priests in most of Central America. A large number of the priests are not indigenous to, are not nationals, because of educational levels and opportunities for people to study to the degree that one would be ordained as a priest. There are also people who work as co-pastors, and I specifically say co-pastors because I don't know of any one who is not a Salvadoran at this point who is the primary pastor in a church. It's always a co-pastor relationship, at least in the churches that I'm aware of. Or lay missioners working in parishes, in base communities. There are people who teach in the seminary. There's a small Baptist seminary in El Salvador, and there are about 4 North Americans who teach in that seminary. There are a lot of health workers, doctors, nurses, as well as lay health workers, primarily doing direct medical services, but also doing a lot of work in training health, what are called health promoters, people who may not have more than a third grade education, but who are remarkably effective in very remote areas where there are no professional health people, and who have run clinics for people in repopulation areas as well as other villages. People who do literacy work, again, a lot of that is training literacy workers, and a lot of it's sort of popular education models. People who lead study tours and delegations of people who come from the United States for a week or 2 weeks. People who spend almost all of their time collecting information on human rights violations, consolidating information and sending it to various offices around the world. There are some church workers that I would still, people I would still define as church workers who work as journalists. There's one good friend who does a number of things, but one of his roles is with the National Catholic Reporter. And there are others who have more of a foundational sort of channeling funding role. There's somebody who works for the Dutch, not the Dutch Reform, but the Reformed Church in America, is that what it is? He's the only representative there, and primarily he is a liaison with Salvadoran churches, and they help funnel funds to various programs. All of these people, I would say, are involved in, Kathy was talking about accompaniment, and that is the idea that perhaps first and foremost, the role of church workers, of international church workers in El Salvador, is one of a ministry of presence. And that takes various forms. In a very, very concrete way, it's protection, because of the fact that our government gives anywhere from $400 to $500 million a year to the government of El Salvador, there's much less chance that we're going to be hurt, because they know that if we are, it's going to be much more of an uproar in the United States. Congress is going to take a much more serious look at things, and they won't be able to get away with sort of the image-building kind of low-intensity conflict that we talked about yesterday for some of you who were in that session. It's certainly also a matter of the kind of all the issues of solidarity that we're talking about, of being present with people, of sharing in their lives, of learning from them, as well as trying to learn from their gifts, as well as offering the gifts that we have. And I think all of those roles have to be put in that context. What organizations are there? I'm doing this because a couple people have asked me that and are sort of really curious about, well, who really works down there, and then what do you do, and what are some of the issues? Just very briefly, the ELCA right now, it's changed a little bit, and I think there's only one person who's specifically, formally, fully supported by the ELCA at this point, who's in El Salvador, works for the Lutheran Church. The United Church of Christ and the Disciples of Christ have a common ministry. There are 2 people who are fully sponsored and 2 others who have an associate relationship. I'm one of those. The Methodist Church has 1 person. The Presbyterian Church has 1. American Baptist churches have 4. The Catholic Church, all different. There's hundreds if you count all the nuns and priests and Jesuit refugee service and lay workers and all that. Of course, it's primarily a Catholic country. In addition to the mainline denominations, the majority of non-Catholic people in the country come from certain volunteer organizations like Mennonite Central Committee. There are 11 people, 11 adults. We have some kids too, but 11 adults working for Mennonite Central Committee. There's a group called Christian Volunteer Ministries, which is an ecumenical group that has about, I think they have 8 or 9 volunteers now, work all different parts of the country, doing a lot of the things that we've talked about. They also have another group that sponsors delegations. Jennifer Casolo, who probably a lot of people heard about a couple years ago, who was arrested in El Salvador and eventually deported, did the delegation work for that organization called CRISPAS. There's the Peace Brigades International, and their primary focus is doing the kind of accompaniment we're talking about. They spend most of their time going around 24 hours a day with union leaders, popular organization leaders, people in communities that are at special risk from death squads, military actions, those kinds of things. Witness for Peace does not work in El Salvador specifically. They sometimes bring delegations there, but they work in Guatemala, and some of you who met Kathy, who was here with me the first couple days, works for Witness for Peace in Guatemala, and then in Nicaragua. The Jesuit refugees, yeah. No, they started specifically in Nicaragua, and now they've expanded to Guatemala just in the last year. So they were making a decision about whether they were going to work in El Salvador or Guatemala. Decided it would be very hard for them to carry their model from Nicaragua to El Salvador, and it's actually difficult in Guatemala too. There are others like Central American Mission Partners is a small group, but some people I think Heather's worked with them, and Jesuit Refugee Service. Okay. All right. What I want to do then is just give you a quick idea of the Mennonite Central Committee, not because I'm pushing that organization, but it gives a clear idea of maybe some of the things that go on, and primarily the kind of issues that we struggle with over solidarity that we were talking about. As I said, there are 11 adult volunteers there. And we, part of our interpretation of solidarity is that we have no MCC projects. There is not one thing that we do on our own. We do things on our own, like sending information back to North American churches and things like that. But in terms of work specifically with Salvadorans, that all comes under our partnership with the Lutheran, the Baptist, and the Catholic churches. And so every one of our volunteers works in a program that is a Salvadoran church program. We are accountable to the people who supervise those programs. As far as our overall program, we do get together as a team every 6 to 8 weeks. We serve as sort of a support community for each other. We draw up program goals for each year that include things like sending information back to the States, translating our experience to North Americans. But even those things are run by an advisory board of Salvadoran church people, and they offer feedback to us and say this is where we think you can play a role or not. People of our 11 people, we have a nurse that does health, that primarily spends her time training health promoters. We have people, she works all, over half of our people work in repopulation villages where refugees, in all of these cases except for one, have come back from Honduras and have reestablished communities and are at special risk in El Salvador because of their history. So we have people who live in those communities. Their first purpose of being there is accompaniment. And then after that comes whatever role they play as a nurse, as an agricultural technician, people who report human rights violations, offer administrative assistance, do literacy work, and also nutrition work. Then there are five of us who work in the city of San Salvador or around the city of San Salvador. One couple works in a marginal community in nutrition. I work in fighting the forced recruitment stuff that we've talked about. And then there are two people who are more coordinators and liaisons with the church partners that we have, which is what I will be doing when I go back. One thing I want to say is that the philosophy of Mennonite Central Committee is that you really can't do much real development in El Salvador now. And so while MCC is primarily seen as a development organization around the world that really puts most of its resources and efforts into agricultural development, literacy, health, those kinds of things. And while we do that in El Salvador, we don't see that as our first and primary purpose. Because the concern is that if you do large development projects in El Salvador, you basically are pacifying the situation because it's eventually going to be co-opted by the government. As long as people's lives improve in sort of an artificial outside way where the government gets credit for it, then you are sort of prolonging the pacification and you're not empowering people to act on their own. That doesn't mean we're going to withhold resources from people. It means you have to play a very, very fine line as to when health promotion is good and when is it not. Or health promotion is usually one of those things that works, but it depends on where you're doing it and what part of the country you're doing it, and who's it going to benefit and who's going to be empowered by it and how you do it. So people are truly empowered, so health promoters are going out and are really empowered by the process and not just pacified by it. We can talk more about that later as well if you'd like. So our goals are, first of all, accompanying, being in solidarity with people, providing the kind of protection, joining in the suffering and the struggle. Secondly, to offer our resources and assistance. Thirdly, to learn from Central Americans and communicate that to the North American Church. And then fourthly, to provide information that might be influential in changing U.S. policy. Okay. Now, what I want to do is just talk a little bit about what are some of the day-to-day struggles that I at least face in terms of what my call to some sense of solidarity and mission is. It's the kind of thing that probably just about anybody who spent any time in a third world country faces. But it is a daily struggle. First of all, there are lifestyle issues. Does solidarity mean living exactly the same lifestyle? Does it mean living in a lifestyle that's at least less than what I live in North America? Or does it mean that I'm a North American and I need to accept that so I can live the lifestyle to which I've become accustomed? I happen to believe that it's certainly not the latter. I'm not sure where it falls on the line with the first two. But, for instance, I go to El Salvador and I am called by the Mennonite Central Committee a volunteer. But as a volunteer, all my expenses are paid and I receive $50 a month for a personal stipend. Now, for North Americans, like $50 a month, how can you do anything on $50 a month? Out of that $50 a month, I have to pay for my clothes. Of course, I don't buy very many in El Salvador. And then anything else I want. If I go out to eat, or I have an ice cream cone, or postage for stamps, those kinds of things. Or if I pay to come back to the United States outside of the times that MCC pays for that, then that would come out of that. Obviously, I have to get about 6 months of stipends before I can come back. But the point is that $50, I mean, I no longer even talk about being a voluntario in El Salvador. That makes no sense to Salvadorans. Because I receive much more money than 85% of the people in that country. I mean, even if my expenses weren't paid, $50 a month is pretty good. But I get $50 a month, plus I don't even have to worry about my food, my travel, my health insurance is covered, all those kinds of things. So I'm not trying to say I'm going to give up my $50 a month, but it's just, it's terminology that's really important that we have to understand. A second question for us on the MCC team are vehicles. We do not have a vehicle. And that's a conscious choice. We have money to buy one. MCC would certainly buy one, and other programs in MCC around the world, they have several. But we have made a choice at this point not to have one, so that we ride buses. We ride public buses in the city. We ride the inner city buses. We do use vehicles quite a bit. In my program that I have, we have to use a private vehicle. Otherwise, we pick somebody up from the military on a bus and bring them back. They'll be recruited off the bus before we get them back. So we have a private, we do have a truck, and we use that a lot. So it's not that we never use them, but we don't have one of our own. But sometimes church leaders say, why don't you guys, Salvadorans say, why don't you have a vehicle? This doesn't make any sense. You have money to buy one. You could do this, this, and this if you had a vehicle. So we constantly struggle with that. Churches' programs usually have some vehicle at least. And so where is the balance between a lifestyle where we have to ride buses and have to live at that level and having a vehicle that at the same time would give us a little bit more leverage on getting some things done? And it's a constant struggle. We would never have one out in the villages where we work. It would only be in the city, because any village where we worked, it would be the only vehicle in the whole village. So we wouldn't do that. Things like housing. When I go back to El Salvador and the work that I have been doing, one of the requirements that the Baptist wanted for me was a telephone. Well, in El Salvador, that automatically means that you're talking about at least a middle-class house. And if you can't just go and live somewhere else and order a telephone, you might be lucky to get one in 2 years. So that automatically means that I certainly haven't lived in a wealthy household, but I've lived in a middle-class household in El Salvador. Wonderful people. I've been very, very lucky. But that's an issue. Or the people who are the coordinators of the program after the offensive of 89, their small little apartment was raided by the National Guard. It was a very, very dicey time when they came back to the country. They left because they were being looked for by name. When they came back, there was still a lot of insecurity about foreigners, and especially in poorer areas. So the decision was made for them to live in a more middle-class neighborhood. What that means is that it's very uncomfortable for campesinos to come to their house. It's in a neighborhood that it's a nice, not by our standards so much, but it's a nice house. Campesinos feel uncomfortable in that neighborhood. So anytime there are meeting setups with them, it's done in a different place. But it does mean a difference in what kind of sort of informal visits can be paid by a lot of people. Was somebody going to ask something?
Well, you don't have any special
They have been working out of their home, and when we go back, we are going to have an office in the Baptist the National Baptist offices, and we will have that.
Would that help work with the campesinos
then? It will, to some degree. Although that office is also in a little bit of a middle class area. And a lot of the time that we spend with people is outside the city anyway, so. It's a good question. What do you do when people ask you for money? That can be anywhere from beggars on the streets, but the more difficult question for me is when people in the church are looking for money for a program, for instance. And MCC is not primarily a funding organization, but we do have some funds. And there's always this constant struggle between when is that appropriate and empowering, when is it not? And then I struggle all the time about I usually take buses at night if I'm out, somewhere. Buses usually start running by 8 o'clock, so I have to take a taxi back. Well, you can take a taxi across the entire city of San Salvador for about $2. So that's nothing for us. But I'm very aware when I'm in a taxi, if somebody I know sees me or sees me get out of it, I feel it. Family would really like for me to come to the wedding. Kathy will certainly be going. But I primarily decided not to go, not because I don't have the money and not because I couldn't squeeze out a few days of time, but because I don't feel comfortable having spent 2.5 months in the States, going back for a month and a half, going to the States again, and then coming back again in December to get married. And to make those kinds of trips is something that people just can't. It's unfathomable to most Salvadorans how I could afford to do that. On the other hand, what we struggle with is the enemy of self-righteousness. While at the same time we're trying to do all this, it's like, there's a constant danger of us becoming very self-righteous about trying to do this nice solidarity work when other North American church workers don't have quite the same attitude. There are missionaries down there that have a house that's as nice as any house in a middle-class suburb, and in Seattle and have VCRs or two or three and TVs and those kinds of things. Or with wealthy Salvadorans. Last night, somebody reminded me of a line in the Romero movie. How many of you have seen the movie Romero? A lot of you, most of you have. There's one line in there where there's a wealthy woman who wants Romero to baptize her baby. And she's basically towards the end saying, "You have abandoned us." And one of the lines is, "We only want to be like our North American friends." And where does that put us? I mean, we go around El Salvador, you know, sort of constantly seeing, I mean, having to be careful not to, but it's still the tendency is to see the wealthy as the enemy. And yet most of the Salvadorans that have some money aren't any better. I mean, some of them are very, very wealthy. But there are many who would certainly be in favor of supporting the government as it is, who live no better lifestyle or have no more wealth than all of us sitting here in this room. So do we have the right to come down there from North America and say, you should be sharing power? And how can we do that? On the program side, there are all sorts of questions related to this kind of development stuff. We've just pulled out of a town. I won't go into detail now because of time, but we've just pulled out of a town of working because of feeling like that the work we were doing was an agricultural loan program and that it wasn't empowering at all, that it was just pacifying the situation. So... Well,
according to your perspective in the government or according to the people who are
according
there?
To other Salvadorans who would be helping, not the people who are getting the loans wouldn't tell us to pull out, of course not, but that was a decision made in consultation with other Salvadoran churches.
Because it
people.
Was showing development and then the government would get credit for that development?
It wasn't really showing development. Because all it was doing was just, they were becoming totally dependent every year on the same program.
Like for instance,
it's pretty complicated.
Literacy programs, if that
I wasn't probably very clear about this. Literacy and health programs are the programs that tend to really empower people. When people learn how to read, and especially the way it's done under the church programs we work, literacy is a very empowering, conscientiousizing process. People really start to learn and take more note about what's really going on. And the same thing happens when health promoters really are empowered to really go out and say, I can do something and I have a sense of dignity. It's more of the economic and sometimes agricultural development programs, depending on how it's done. That's a good question, though. It's an important distinction. This situation is very complicated. It basically meant that what happened was that we had really no partnership. We had no partner in that village. We were basically working on our own at that point and decided that was not appropriate for us to do. And other Salvadorans with whom we consulted agreed that the program itself was not a particularly good thing to be doing. So, the final thing I'll mention around these kind of things is just confronting different styles of working. Every day I have to deal with, and I think I've done fairly well at it, but there are things that I would consider disorganization that Salvadorans would not consider at all to be disorganized. There's also a way in which I want to be much more open about dealing with conflicts and disagreements, whereas most Salvadorans in an office situation or organization situation are much more sort of subdued and subtle about that. So there's always a question of, where's the line between completely accepting that as a cultural difference, and sometimes is it appropriate for me to offer a suggestion that I think may improve the situation? Sometimes I've done that, and it has been appropriate, and it's been helpful, and other times it has been completely out of line. It's very clear that it has been. So that's a constant struggle. Okay, let's end with that, and... just talk a little, or before we do it, what I want to do now is just talk a little bit about North America and do that more in a discussion. But before I do that, are there questions that people would have about stuff?
You were talking about all these issues.
Most of them wouldn't. There's one friend that I have who, well, I think I've told this story before here. His name is Juan Carlos. He's like 27, and he's been working in base community since he was about 15. Actually, since he was 9, but really working since he was about 15, 16. And has just, almost all of his best friends are dead now. I mean, and he told me on his 25th birthday, he said, "I never thought I'd live this long." But he asked me one time why I was in El Salvador, just sort of out of the blue. And I sort of talked a little bit about why I was here. And he said, "Well, okay, that sounds good. I'll hold you to it." And I thought, whoa, I don't want this guy who has this kind of commitment holding me accountable. But it was also one of the sort of the, it was also one of the moments of real connection that I've really had in El Salvador, was the fact that he cared enough about his friendship with me to say that he'd hold me accountable. And that's what Central Americans do for each other. And sometimes they're a little hesitant to do that with us, and they don't do it very often. I don't have a real good, clear answer to that. I guess several comments that come to mind are, first of all, the situation in El Salvador isn't exactly the same, as you well know. There's not sort of the sense of the people who are really working in base communities or in churches or in popular organizations even really having much of an opportunity to get out. Now, some people leave the country, and that may be comparable. I guess I would also say that one of the things I feel in El Salvador about people leaving the country is that it's very difficult and probably inappropriate for me as a white North American male to in any way pass judgment on someone in El Salvador who's been living in absolute poverty all their lives to want to leave and try to go to the United States. And I guess I'd probably feel like that in terms of my specific personal role, that where the line for me in terms of being in solidarity with my Hispanic sisters and brothers in the States would be is that I probably could not be the one either who encouraged Hispanics to stay in the barrio. But in terms of a process that's empowering, I mean, I do think that part of what's happening in El Salvador is a process of community building, and I think there's a lot we can learn from Central Americans about community and what that means. And if there's a sense of community building and empowerment that comes out of the Christian faith, then those people who are empowered by that, I would say at least most of them would come out of that empowerment still being committed to the same community. That's not very concrete or very clear or specific, and I don't know what else really to say at this point. Maybe other people have comments on it.
Are you trying to empower the community or empower individuals or both? I think that's part of what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Empower individuals.
Right.
May be simply to improve his own lot. Mm-hmm. Or is there a real desire to empower the community, and is that built into the individuals who are empowered?
Mm-hmm.
Do they actually become leaders when they're empowered?
Well, I think both to some degree goes on. Clearly in El Salvador the focus, especially if you look at the refugee resettlement areas, I mean, there's a sense of community there, which is, it's interesting, we could spend a lot of time talking about that, because basically it's been the fact that they were forced into refugee camps and spent 8 to 10 years living together that sense of community out of survival came. And so there really is a sense that you're empowering the community, because everybody realizes that the only way they're going to survive in El Salvador is through community. But within those communities, there are clearly individuals who are finding a new sense of sort of excitement about learning a new skill and being able to lead things and being empowered. But I know very few who have left at the same time. So I don't pretend that I have that all sorted out in terms of what really sort of the dynamics are.
It seems like the values that in the empowerment process are different. I don't know about the Hispanic culture, but the African American culture seems to be empowerment is combined in the American experience of getting up, getting out of the ghetto, and making a lot of money and getting cars and things like that. Whereas I don't think that's the kind of empowerment that's happening within the communities in El Salvador. They're not talking about moving into a position of the rich and being, and I'm not sure, but that's my sense, is that it's more empowerment of what can you do for the community than what can you do specifically as an individual.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, there's certainly a lot of Salvadorans that do just simply want to be rich, but the kind of communities we're talking about in the church communities, I think you're absolutely right. Maybe I should just say here, I think there's a real danger in romanticizing Salvadorans or any Central Americans and coming up with this idea that every Salvadoran is just this remarkable saint that has unending courage and faith. And it's not the case. I think it almost highlights the amount of courage and faith and spirit that people in Central America have if we recognize the realities that everyone's not like that and that no one's really a saint. But, okay. Let's just talk a little bit about the kinds of things that those of us who live in North America do, and what solidarity means in this sense, people who are not living in Central America. And I want to say that I think the work here is as or more important than those of us, the work that we do living there. Maybe we can just, well, I don't know if you see, we don't even need to write them down. What are some of the things, I know people here have already been working on stuff, and what would you say is... How does solidarity play itself out in concrete ways? Let's just spend a few minutes sharing ideas with each other. I know some people here are looking for ideas. Other people are pretty experienced resources in this regard.
The protection of some of the escapees that's going on.
Okay, right. Working specifically with refugees, and there's a lot of work going on that everywhere, just about, at least in the major cities. Other stuff?
A lot of it is sharing what you know. So many people don't know anything about the situation and the United States' role in it.
Okay.
So, I mean, that's just on top of anything else, but just in our daily lives, sharing with people what you know.
Okay. I agree.
How about the Sister Parish program?
Mm-hmm.
Where you join together with at least one congregation down there. I mean, that's a reasonable thing to do. I don't know how well it's worked.
It's very mixed. I think there's some people, some parishes that have very, very good experience with that and very powerful ones. And I think those parishes that have gone into it with clear expectations and have been very careful about the power dynamics and the money dynamics and all of that, sometimes expectations are created and then either it becomes a relationship where money is sent, and that sort of, I think, to some degree can really contaminate the relationship depending on how it's done, as well as sometimes expectations are created and then on one side or the other, very often the church in North America doesn't respond or doesn't keep up with it. But I think it's an excellent way to go for people who are, churches are really willing to make a long-term commitment and stick with it and maybe send some people down there every now and then. The church I'm actually still a member of in Boston has had a relationship like that for a few years now. It's been really powerful. Other ideas? Yeah, Kathy, I know you've...
We have a project that I mentioned a bit. This is not Salvador, it's in Nicaragua, but the unique thing about it, I think, is that it's a women's project. There's a group in a small village in Nicaragua called Mulukuku, the organized women of Mulukuku, they call themselves, and they ask us if we would be like a sister group in the United States. And they've determined what their priorities are for the women in this little village, which is basically the women are rebuilding the village and are setting up a women's center, which they want to be a health center and an education center and a safe house for women in the village. And they've asked us to be, well, an emotional support and solidarity, but also financial support for them. So we've been engaged in trying to do some fundraising for that, and some education along with it in North America, educating people about what's going on in Nicaragua, which is a different reality than Salvador right now, but which is a reality that's gotten a lot worse, particularly economically. And if anybody's interested in something like that, that's really plugged into women's issues particularly and women's health issues, I've got one copy of the newsletter about it, because we put out a little newsletter about it, and I can show that to people and put people on the mailing list.
There's a children's component to the project also, in case you have a Sunday school connection of your own children, because we're sending down all kinds of school supplies and sports equipment and musical instruments, because there's a tremendous shortage of all of that, especially the school supplies.
One of the interesting things, too, in terms of the sports equipment, the people, this is in the central region of Nicaragua, and this is an area where there are Contra resettlements, and they want sports equipment because they feel like sports equipment is real important in the whole resettlement of the Contras and the reconciliation process. They said if we can play games together, it enables us to be more reconciled with each other. It's just, it's always a fascinating thing to me to see how Nicaraguan people handle reconciliation and how concrete they are about how it can be done. But that's, we had some people from Ulukuku in St. Louis in May, and that was one specific thing they said, we need baseball. We need to be able to play baseball together. That's very important.
It's always important for Nicaraguans to play baseball.
Yes, it is. Very important.
Other specific things that people have done that you would offer as a resource to others or know about? Not that you necessarily. Yeah, I would suggest in that regard that, I mean, one of the most crucial things is having alternative news. Somebody, I think you talked about or asked about that yesterday in the session, is getting on some mailing lists. And there's, in the United Church of Christ, there's a program called Global Advocates, and you can get on there for different parts of the world. The ELCA, I'm pretty sure, has a similar kind of thing. So you give regular updates on what's going on. You can get regular updates on what's going on in Central America, as well as legislation, and write letters. That's something you can do on your own. And at the same time, I would also encourage people to find groups. I'm not very good at writing letters on my own, but here at Holden, we started a group when I was here a few years ago in which we got together and wrote letters together. Or groups that are going to do other things too, not just letters. But I really think if we don't have communities to support us in this, it's going to be real hard to sustain ourselves if we're just doing this stuff alone.
I was in Salvador here in June, and whether you're talking on military or government or campesinos, all of them sooner or later would give the phrase, the war is really fought in Washington, because that's where the money comes to continue to support the particular structures that are going on. And so that in that sense, for people within the United States, the way they kind of continue the war is through benign neglect in terms of their congresspersons who basically are formula or whatever. But that sense of writing letters, protests, supporting some of the Congress people who are critical of the policy and what that entails is tremendously significant and is really something that all of us can do in terms of this sense of solidarity.
Right. Just to quote a Central American, it comes out of a book of quotes from a conference. The quote is simply, to talk of love is not enough. Our people are dying. I mean, we really have to take responsibility, like we talked about yesterday, for what our government, what role our government and we play in all this. Jim?
I think there's a spiritual dimension to this.
Just a few other things here that people can take a look at. There is a boycott of Salvadoran coffee. Primarily Folgers is the primary target. you want to, that's being done by neighbor to neighbor. I have some good friends that are working in that, so if you want to take a look at that, the Center for Global Education. Those of you from Minneapolis, there is an excellent Central American Resource Center in Minneapolis. Actually, Jane Austin, who worked at Holden for several years when I was here, is one of the key people in that. And then there's stuff like the Lutheran Coalition on Latin America, LUCOLA. For those of you who are Lutheran, is an excellent source of information. They bring delegations down every now and then. Right here, Raquel Rodriguez. First page, article. Raquel is Jose's sister, whom I know as well. And then Kathy just gave me this. This is the Jesuit University in San Salvador puts out what's called the Letter to the Churches. And it is translated into English, and you can get that. And then a final thing that I would just mention, I've been handing these out. Most of you probably have already gotten one, but if you haven't, I really think a good way to get started in some of this is through some of the Urgent Action Alert networks, because you can do something, it's extremely important, and you also get regular updates on some of the situations going on. So I have some of those pamphlets here. Kiwanis is the one that I know of. It's Christian Urgent Action Network for Emergency Support in El Salvador.
For example, on this here folder thing, how effective would this be on a going by basis? What are we really doing?
Yeah.
That's my question.
Well, it would be effective enough that the coffee plantation owners in El Salvador are upset about it. And that's as good an indication to me that there's something there. Now, I don't think that the coffee boycott itself is going to change the whole situation. But, you know, there was a whole barge of Salvadoran coffee that went up and down the coast of the western coast of the United States, and they organized longshoremen enough to where they would not unload it. And I think it eventually was. And went all the way, it started in Los Angeles, went to several ports as far as Seattle and came all, I think it was eventually unloaded. But you know, that was every day in the Salvadoran papers, the coffee boycott was a big thing about a year ago when it was being launched. And people were protesting against it, saying this is only going to hurt the poor campesino workers. Meanwhile, the campesino workers, they can't openly come out in favor of it, but if you talk to people in the unions, I haven't myself personally, but I know people who have, they basically support the idea.
So the people themselves support it.
Yeah.
The boycott.
Yeah. The workers, the plantation owners don't really like it too much. Let me, we just got a couple minutes left, and I guess I just wanted to close with a couple final thoughts about solidarity. As we talked about yesterday, I really believe that the United States approach to things in Central America, especially as we talk about low-intensity conflict, is really geared towards helping to prevent us from seeing reality there and confronting reality. So that I think part of solidarity, and perhaps the most important part initially, is that we start to confront the reality and we start to grieve. And I just want to read a couple things to share with you. This is a poem by Ariel Dorfman, who is a Chilean who had to leave Chile and then spent a lot of time outside of Chile. And this is his response to, well, I'll just read it. Something must be happening to my antennas. I find myself crying at the end of General Hospital, at the television show. I swear it's true. The worst soap opera on TV, the cheapest song, a goodbye on a platform, or a broken balloon in a child's hand are all it takes, and I get a lump in my throat. My eyes burn like acid. My nose itches. My heart pounds. My breathing becomes irregular. My tears will come, and my eyes grow red. I know the tricks and techniques of the movies. I've studied how the violins manipulate us. I spent my life denouncing Doris Day. But during General Hospital, something clouds over inside, and something wet and salty runs down my cheeks. I'm like a stone when I receive the news of your death. List of crippled people come off the plane, your best friend limping. I learned that they killed your sister on a street corner. The children in the slums eat cats and dogs if they can find them. You haven't worked for 15 months. Another worker clubbed, the noise of a stick on a shoulder.